This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to read a good book. And boy, do I have a good book for you today. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper today one of my favorite authors, Jeffrey Deaver. Not only is he an international best-selling author, he's written more than 30 books. His newest book is just so exciting, and I am so very, very happy to welcome Jeffrey to this program. The new book is called The Cutting Edge. Jeff, are you there?
Hi, Patsy. I am here. How are you doing today?
Okay, great. Well, this is really wonderful. I've just celebrated the third anniversary of my program, and you were on last year just after my second anniversary, so I'm so excited to have you back again.
I remember, and when I saw your name on the list, of course, I'm doing a bunch of interviews today, I said, oh my gosh, I had so much fun chatting with Patsy last year, so I'm glad we're back together again.
Well, thank you. You know, I love your books always, but boy, this new one, The Cutting Edge, is fantastic. It's amazing.
Oh, well, thank you. And I think we should say it's a bit sick and twisted. There's no question about that. But I had great fun writing it, and it takes us to a different world. If I can just kind of mention where it came from.
Absolutely.
I always look for I'd call it a hook or something slightly different, a different world to write about. Now, this is a book featuring Lincoln Rhyme and Amelia Sachs from The Bone Collector, and it follows my typical formula. It goes very, very quickly, takes place over just a few days, lots of twists and turns, big surprise endings. There are three and a half surprise endings.
I know.
In the book. But I need something new and fresh at the same time. So what I decided to do was look into crimes in the Diamond District in New York City. And I didn't want to do your typical caper story. In fact, in the opening scene, there's a horrific murder in a diamond dealer in the Diamond District, and yet the perpetrator doesn't take these hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of stones. So what's he up to? Well, it turns out he's up to something pretty nasty. He's a fellow called the Promiser, and he tracks down young couples who are on the verge of getting married and have bought their diamond ring or maybe gone to a wedding dress shop or talking to a wedding planner. And for reasons that are ultimately revealed as we peel back the layers of the onion of The Cutting Edge, we find that he is resentful.
We don't want to give away. No. We have to. That's always the problem with your books. They are so exciting. It's almost like
it's impossible to talk about them.
I know. I just want to tell people, pick it up, start reading it, because from the first chapter just grabs you. You always are able to do that. You take us. We care so much about the characters, and sometimes we know they're going to be killed, but we already care so much about them. And so that's why I think your books are always so exciting, because everybody you introduce has a reason to be introduced, and you make them so real to us. And this is no different. This one, the first chapter, is fantastic. And I love, I'm telling you, the next part, it's just so good. Everybody just.
I teach courses in writing, and it's writing commercial fiction. This is not literature, and I love fine arts writing, of course. But I'm an entertainer, and I want to follow what I feel is one of the best prototypes for writing that there is. And this is a fellow named Mickey Spillane who wrote murder mysteries, pulp fiction, he admitted it, in the 1950s and 60s. And he said this: people don't read books to get to the middle. We read books to get to the end. And it's the writer's job to grab the readers on the first page, not just the first chapter, but on the first page, and race them through the book. And that's what I try to do. So I really appreciate your noting that once you start the book, it's nonstop. It just doesn't let go for the entire X number of pages, to 300 pages or whatever it is. It just grabs you and races you through the story.
Exactly. Well, and as I said, I always love all of your characters, but I want to say that the character of Vimal Lahori is one of my favorite that you've ever written.
Well, thank you. Vimal is a very interesting character. He's a young man, South Asian, came from Kashmir, the disputed territory that is claimed by both Pakistan and by India, a bit by China as well. Now, he is a second third generation, South Asian or Indian in America. And his father, as was his grandfather, were famous diamond tears, and those are master diamond cutters. And Vimal is a brilliant, talented sculptor, but he wants to be a fine art sculptor. He doesn't want to cut diamonds. He feels that it's a waste of time creating this cosmetic item that people don't really appreciate, as opposed to fine art sculpture. And part of the conflict is his escaping from the promiser who wants to kill him as a witness, and part of the conflict, too, is his fear of disappointing his father and going in a different direction and not becoming the third generation diamond tear. And I spent a lot of time crafting that character and constructing the conflicts that he goes through, both internally and with his father and other people in his family, because I think the book should have depth to them. And it's this, I call it, you know, with affection, the soap opera element of the story that's just as valid as the crime.
And as I said, always your characters have depth. But Vimal, in really, this is an example to all you writers out there. If you want to really understand how a great writer like Jeffrey Deaver creates a character, in a few paragraphs, I cared so much about this boy. And I was so impressed with what he held a stone in his hand and what he could see in that stone and how you describe it. And after I finished that paragraph, I wanted to see what he saw in just a stone, a solitary bird, January. The way you wrote it, it's just so beautifully done.
That was inspired by Michelangelo's philosophy. And the epigram in the book is a quote from Michelangelo, who said, I don't have it in front of me, but this is pretty close, "I saw the angel in the stone, and I set him free," in the sense that Michelangelo felt that every piece of marble had a statue within it, and it was his job simply to chip away the parts that were not the statue, the person inside or the object inside. And I love that. And Vimal carries around a book, one of his most prized possessions, of sketches by Michelangelo, who was an artist, of course, as well, a painter, as well as a sculptor. And he's just enthralled with this concept of finding the truth within something as mundane as just a hunk of stone that he happens to have in his hand.
Well, as I said, because from a writer's point of view, if they're looking for a chapter, always your first chapters are great. But this second chapter, where you introduce Vimal and make us care so much about him in such beautiful language, and I was thinking to myself, now, I know, of course, you work very hard on making sure that your book is as perfect as it can be. You rewrite, like all great writers do. And I was wondering, do you keep that very first draft of your work for sort of posterity? Or do you just wipe things out?
No, I don't wipe things out. I keep it more for security, frankly. Let me just explain to your listeners who there may very well be some aspiring writers out there. I suspect so, because you have interviews about culture and writing quite a bit, I know, and are an expert in the field. So your listeners might be interested in this. I plan my book out for months ahead of time. I spent 8 months structuring the book. I have an entire outline before I start to write a single word. Joyce Carol Oates, the wonderful writer, said, you cannot write your first sentence until you know what the last sentence is. Now, that doesn't mean you have to have the actual last sentence in your head, but you do need to know where the book is going. And so I will spend that 8 months crafting an outline. The outline for The Cutting Edge was about 100, and I can't remember exactly, but say 130 pages or so, and then I have hundreds of pages of research. So when I sit down to write the book, I know exactly where it's going to go. I can write the beginning at the end. I can write the at the end at the beginning, the middle, whenever I want. So I write very quickly. It takes me about 2 months to write the first draft of a 125,000-word book. But then I have to go back and refine it. And that is when, over the course of those many, many drafts, that is when I kind of find those moments of inspiration that you so kindly described as creating Vimal and looking at the stone, where he was very moved, and I hope readers are moved by that. But I do keep the early drafts because I'm worried that maybe there'll be a computer hiccup of some kind and I might lose something. So I do. And I go back and look at them occasionally, but generally the writing is pretty clunky. And that would tend to make me feel bad.
I was thinking, you know, for posterity, because, you know, there are always these grad students who are doing their thesis on different authors. And I'm thinking, in many cases, the grad students of the future are going to be have a big problem, because so many authors, they write on Word and they get rid of everything. So there's no comparison. So everything looks like, you know, it came out perfectly that first time. And,
sure.
You know, and I think it would be useful for students to see that it doesn't come out perfect. You have to work on it. It's a craft. It's an art. And so this first chapter, the first time you write a chapter, it's not going to be as perfect as it is by the time.
Oh, you mentioned my rewriting. I'll do. I rewrite a book of my 50 times or so. I do half on the computer because it's very easy to move whole chapters then, or I might want to search and replace or find a paragraph. I can't remember exactly where it is, but I just do the search function and put in a key word, and then I find it very easily. But then it's very important to print the book out. We respond to writing on paper differently than we do on the screen. And it's a better experience. Now, I read ebooks. I have all sorts of e-readers. I have a Kindle. I read on my iPhone. And that's wonderful. It's convenient. I sell a lot of books in ebook form. But I just have found that my experience is when I print out my draft and read it, I see things that I miss on the screen. I have a different experience with it. And so for your, again, your listeners who maybe want to become writers, remember that you have to edit toward the end of the process on paper. I strongly recommend that.
Well, that's why I call this Joy on Paper, because it's a joy for readers to be able to see the words on paper, just as it is a joy for writers to actually get the words down on paper. But it does affect your brain in a different way.
I do believe that, exactly. Yes, in fact, I was teaching one of my courses, and a student, in the maybe 80, 100 people in the class, and I say you have to keep up with technology, and you may want to, you know, pick your word process. You may use Scrivener. You may want to use Word. I use Word, but it's whatever you're comfortable with. And I said, but the days it's come a long way from when people wrote their entire book in longhand. And this woman raised her hand. No, she still does. Doesn't at the end before it goes to the editor. And she's a published author. Before it goes to the editor, she will transcribe it onto electronic media of some kind, some word processor. But she wrote the entire book, many drafts, by hand. And again, if it works for her, good, that's wonderful.
Well, some people do it. And Douglas Brunt, for example, who wrote Ghosts of Manhattan, he writes on his legal pad. He writes it out. His first draft is always, you know, on his legal pad. And I was thinking, well, and you know, you're a lawyer, so you know that those nice yellow sheets, legal pads are nice. And from a historical, from a you know, someday a historian's point of view, they would they love those pages.
Sure. You know? Well, I wrote one of my first books in a notebook by longhand. What I found was that it somehow I can touch type because I was a journalist and I learned to touch type a long time ago. And the writing by hand was too slow for me. I found it very frustrating. I couldn't get the ideas down. I've also tried dictating, and that moved too quickly. I tend to speak quickly, and my thoughts can be a bit jumbled, but the typing was just the right speed, sort of the Goldilocks aspect, you know, handwriting too slow, dictating too fast, but the delay in thinking and typing was just perfect for me. So again, it's whatever really works for you.
Now, have you ever invented a word? Have you taken a word and like a noun and turned it into a verb, which so many people are doing nowadays, and sometimes it's getting a little bit on my nerves sometimes.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, but in, as a matter of fact, I believe I did. In one of the Lincoln Rhyme books, Lincoln had a minor, I guess I would say, a bit of an argument with someone. Now, Lincoln, I should add, is not really like me, except in one sense. I'm a pretty strict grammarian. I think it's very important to understand the rules of grammar and punctuation and syntax. Now, you can break them when it's appropriate. You can break those rules when it's appropriate, but you need a good reason to do that because the rules of grammar and spelling and punctuation are created for clear communication. That's really what it's all about. But what you just said, Patsy, is interesting because somebody had used, this wasn't exactly it, but I think it was a character had said, I authored the memo. And an author, of course, has traditionally been a noun. It's not a verb. And so Lincoln says, I'm not really pleased with that. And the fellow says, with what? He said, you just verbized a noun. and not verbalized, but verbized a noun, meaning turning a noun into a verb. And the character didn't quite get it. But I hope readers laughed at that because Lincoln, in his very wry approach, had done basically the same thing. He turned a noun into a verb. So I think I am responsible for the verb verbizing, which of course is a grammatical mistake. So maybe, Patsy, this will become a meme around the internet that Jeffrey Deaver created a word that will now fall into popular culture.
Okay. Well, that one. Okay. They're doing it with a lot of words now. They really are. Sometimes it's a little too much. But let's talk a little bit about Lincoln Rhyme. And this is wonderful because, you know, of course, everybody, you know, has seen The Bone Collector if they haven't read the book. But they should read the book because the book is better. I mean, the movie's fine, but the book, there's nothing like reading it on paper. And, of course, it's always exciting. You know, Amelia Sachs and Lincoln Rhyme are, wow, they are a couple of, you know, that really are going down in history forever because it's a fascinating couple.
Yes. When I created Lincoln a few years ago, I wanted a unique character, somebody who had to outthink.
Like 14 books ago.
14, yes. The Cutting Edge is the 14th in the series. And you know, he was kind of in reaction to the typical action hero who, at the end, the climactic scene, you know, remembers he hit a gun somewhere and pulls out the gun and shoots the bad guy. Or, you know, the bad guy punches him and he has a recovered memory that his father taught him to kickbox when he was a kid. So then he kickboxes the villain and wins. I wanted a hero who could outthink the villain, but who had to outthink the villain. Because Lincoln, being a quadriplegic, is unable, of course, to pull out the gun or to kickbox. Well, now these books are action stories too, so I need somebody to pull out the gun at some point, or to jump in the car and chase down the bad guys. And that is his partner, Amelia, both professional partner and romantic partner. And they form, it's like a symbiotic relationship that they, together, his side, the rational thinking, and hers, which is the intuitive and also the gutsy side, together are required to track down bad guys like the Promiser and the Cutting Edge or some of my other classic villains, of which there are many. I have a lot of sick and twisted characters in my book.
Yes, you do. But that comes from a very vivid imagination. And I think from years of reading well and reading a lot, which I always tell all of my listeners that really, because there is, it's just so good to read. Just, it's so wonderful to see those words. It takes you into a different place. And it's even if there's a lot of bad stuff going on in your books, it's actually better than what's on television. So turn off the television and read a book.
I will say that I am very conscious of violence. My books are not gory at all. For instance, you'll never see an explicit scene of the crime. It all occurs off camera. That opening scene you mentioned, we never actually see the specifics of anyone getting horribly hurt. That comes afterwards. But this touches on why, as you were just saying, and I want to expand on that a little if I could, Patsy, that this is why I think books are the most emotionally engaging artistic experience we can have. Now, we can look at a piece of art, a piece of sculpture. We can listen to a piece of music. We can watch some of the wonderful shows on TV and some of the wonderful movies. But those are basically passive forms of entertainment. A book requires the readers to become partners with the author. So we kind of, as readers, we kind of write the book along with the author, because we create those images in our head, and we hear the voices, and we smell the smells, and maybe hear the music in the background that the author is talking about.
Well, so in your hands, we do, and I'm, now you said, in the first chapter we don't see any of the gore, but it's like I lived through it. I mentally saw it as just from what you wrote. So it's like it's there. But that's the sign of a great writer, which is what you are.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Participating. And when I do teach my courses, what you had just referred to reading, and that's exactly what I say to my students when the question of continuing education comes up. I said, well, come to seminars like this one, but the most important thing is to read. Read every book you get your hands on, and not just in the genre you like. Our horizons can be expanded by reading poetry, by reading literature, by reading, say you're a crime writer like me, read some science fiction, read some dystopian young adult books, and that will kind of expand your own horizons as a writer.
Okay, well, that's great advice for writers, and my advice to all the listeners out there is that they have to get The Cutting Edge. It's Jeffrey Deaver's newest, number 14 in this wonderful series, and I just, want to thank you so much for being on the program, because I've been celebrating the third anniversary. I'm thinking of all the great authors that I've spoken to. You are right up there, because I just always get so excited with your books, because I know I'm going to have that thrill. As I said, when somebody can take, as you did, and write so beautifully about one character, Vimal, who stays in your mind, this is the sign of a great author. So that's what you are. So I'm very, very happy that you were on today.
Oh, you're very kind, Patsy. Thank you. And I really enjoyed our conversation, as always. And congratulations on year three. I'll look forward to year four.
Okay. Well, you'll have another book by then.
I certainly will.
I'm sure. Do you like working on a deadline? You have always a year deadline?
My deadlines are self-imposed. I look for I work out arrangements with my publishing company to make sure that they will publish me once a year at least, because I want to get my books into the hands of readers.
Okay. Well, everybody, get Jeffrey Deaver's new book, The Cutting Edge. It's available wherever books are sold, and he has also a web page that you can go to. Again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to be back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543. From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8, it's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life. Dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try, but first he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do. A little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all, even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You hope, written by a true American hero. You'll love this book, now available on Amazon. So get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back, and I am so happy to welcome my next guest, Steve Brusate, whose new book, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, A New History of a Lost World, is just fantastic. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Okay, great. Well, this is amazing. This book is wonderful. You know, it's nonfiction, but it reads like a novel. I'm turning the pages. It's so exciting. And I was thinking this morning, you know, I broadcast here out of Clearwater, Florida. And so there I am sitting this morning watching dinosaurs fly past my window. And it was really exciting because of your book. I now, every time I see a seagull flying and I get a lot of them, there I am thinking about you.
Yep, I see the same. We have seagulls all over here in Edinburgh in Scotland, where I live now and where I teach. And it's just mind-boggling when you look at birds today just to think that they came from the dinosaurs, that they are modern day dinosaurs. They are part of that great evolutionary story of dinosaurs. And, you know, a very important part of the rise and fall of the dinosaurs. And I'm glad you enjoy the book. I think that's really cool that you kind of think that it reads like a novel. And I'm glad to hear that because it is a story I've tried to tell, this history of dinosaurs, where they came from and how they rose up and how they went extinct. And it's an incredible storyline. It really is. I think it's one of the greatest stories in the history of our planet, so hopefully I've been able to do it justice.
Well, you definitely do, and it's so funny because I every morning I'm sitting there watching the with my maybe around my third cup of coffee, because I start drinking early in the morning, but when the seagulls start coming out, and I always think of Jonathan Livingston's seagull, but now I'm going to have to think of Jonathan Livingston dinosaur.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing that to me, which is with seagulls, you know, I think they're the same everywhere around the world, but certainly here, you know, they're notorious for attacking people on the beach. They dive bomb down. They try to take people's French fries and ice cream and all of this. And I think when a seagull does that, you can see the cunning. You can see the violence. You know, you can see the inner velociraptor in a seagull. And I just think that's so cool to feel that connection with the world of ancient prehistory like that.
Well, actually, I have been terrified by, you know, I know better than to go out there and start throwing bread around like some people do. And they come in this massive quantities of birds that they just, it's terrifying. So I'm now thinking, wow, if those were a little bit bigger.
Yes, they were. And the dinosaurs, what is so thrilling about the dinosaurs is they were around for such a long time. They were an empire, and they dominated the Earth for over 150 million years. And yes, they do live on today as birds, which is amazing. But in the past, long before there were humans, you had T-Rexes, and you had Brontosauruses, and you had Triceratops. You had all of these fantastic creatures living all over the world, every continent, every conceivable environment. The dinosaurs were on top of nature. They were the dominant animals before us, and really we now wear the crown that the dinosaurs once wore, and hopefully we can learn a bit from the dinosaurs to the point where we don't go the way of the dinosaurs.
Exactly. And as I said, this book is really so good. I always love to learn. And so when you have a book like this, and then you also are just so entertained with all your little anecdotes and stories about your travels. I mean, like, do you have like the best job in the world? I mean, everybody wants your job. You have just carved a niche for yourself. I mean, you are such an authority now on dinosaurs. Everybody turns to you, BBC and everybody else, because you know all about them. And you write so very compellingly that it makes people want to know more.
I do think I have the best job in the world. You know, it's humbling, really, to think about how fortunate you can be to spend your life traveling around, digging up dinosaurs, studying new species, finding and studying these fossils that have never been seen by humans before, that tell stories of vanished worlds from millions, hundreds of millions of years ago, and to get to work with so many people. And one of the things I try to do in the book is tell a lot of the stories of, yeah, myself traveling around digging up dinosaurs, but also the stories of some of my colleagues, some of these other paleontologists all over the place, this very diverse lot of people, men and women, and especially younger people, and especially in developing countries like China and Brazil and Argentina. These are the people making the discoveries, and a lot of them are real characters. A lot of them seem like characters from a novel, but these are the men and women that are finding dinosaurs these days, and I'm very fortunate to be part of a field like this. It is endlessly fascinating.
Well, you know, my grandparents came from the old country, and they got the 40 acres and a mule kind of thing. So my family owns 80 acres of land in northern Michigan, and I've always wanted to find out, do you think we have any dinosaurs up there? Because I've always thought about, well, when I'm ready to retire, I'm going to go up to back up to the farm, and I'm going to get myself, I'm going to start just digging like crazy until I find some dinosaurs.
That's funny. You know, I'm from Illinois originally. I'm from near Chicago. And it seems to be the opposite, really, is people from Michigan, they usually move to Florida, not the other way around, right? Which part of Michigan is it that you're
I'm a Youper from right up there in near Barraga and Hancock, and you know, we have a lot of copper mines. Now they're all empty, but we had a lot of copper mines, and I've always wondered if there's any chance that we would have dinosaurs there. I would, you know, start I used to dig with a spoon, but maybe I'd get a little, you know, when I was a kid, because I would either find gold or I'd find dinosaurs.
Yeah, I must confess I don't know a whole lot about the Upper Peninsula. I have some cousins that are from there, but I've never actually been to the Upper Peninsula myself. But what I do know about it is that the rocks there are really old. They're some of the oldest rocks in all of North America. These are rocks that are billions of years old. So these rocks are from a long time before the dinosaurs, and there are fossils there. But I don't think there are any dinosaurs. So if you do find some, they'd probably be the first. But the upside to that, though, is that the rocks that are there are so old that they put the dinosaurs to shame. The dinosaurs merely lived, you know, 100-some million years ago. Some of these rocks in the Upper Peninsula are a few billion years old. And if you really want to feel the depths of time, look at a rock, stand on a rock that is billions of years old, and just think about everything that rock has experienced. And that, you know, I think these deep timelines are kind of hard to understand anyway, because they're so out of scale with, you know, human experience. But the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. It's incredibly old, and it's a fragile place, but also a robust place, and there have been times of great environmental and climactic upheaval. There have been changes in temperature and rises and falls in sea level, and the continents have come together and broken apart, and big volcanoes have erupted, and asteroids have hit, and it's animals like dinosaurs that actually had to put up with these changes.
So
dinosaurs and other fossils are relevant.
What's the oldest dinosaur we know? When did they start and when did they end?
Yeah, the oldest. Yep. The origin story of dinosaurs, to me, is really fascinating, because all great empires have to start somehow. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day, right? That's what the cliche says, and it's the same with dinosaurs. They didn't sweep across the world the moment they originated. In fact, they were very humble for the early part of their history. Really, the first 50 million years of their history, dinosaurs were living in the shadows. They were small animals. The first ones were just about the size of a house cat. They were awkward, gangly-looking animals. They ran around on all fours on these stilty arms and legs, and they were living right after a horrible extinction that killed off almost all living things. There were these big volcanoes that erupted, and that almost cleared the world, but it cleared the deck as well, so it gave new groups of animals a chance to rise up. And dinosaurs were one of those groups, but so were crocodiles, and so were turtles, and so were mammals. And it was some of these other animals that were eclipsing dinosaurs for a long time. And it was only after another extinction, when there were some more volcanoes that wiped out a bunch of the crocodiles, that dinosaurs wrestled control. And that's when dinosaurs became dominant. That's when they spread around the world. That's when they grew to huge sizes. That's when they started to develop feathers and wings. And so it's an origin story that took a long time. It took dinosaurs quite a while to become the most successful animals that ever lived. And these first, very oldest, most humble little dinosaur precursors lived about 250 million years ago, a long, long, long time ago. And it was only about 200 million years ago that dinosaurs started to spread around the world and properly become the dominant Brontosaurus, T-Rex, Triceratops types of animals that we all know and love.
So literally most of the Earth was covered with dinosaurs? I mean, there were dinosaurs everywhere?
That's right. Dinosaurs look like they lived pretty much everywhere, at least after they eventually spread around the world. At the beginning of their time, they only lived in certain places. They only lived in the more humid and cooler places. They couldn't really live in the warmer places, the deserts. But later on, they spread everywhere, and they lived on every continent. And we find their fossils today almost everywhere where there are rocks of the right age and the right type. So there are dinosaur fossils from Antarctica. There are dinosaur fossils from above the Arctic Circle in Alaska. There are dinosaurs from Australia, from New Zealand, from across North America and Europe and Africa, South America. They're everywhere. They were utterly dominant. They were the premier animals for over 150 million years.
It's sometimes hard to contemplate. That's why I love dinosaur movies. I've always loved dinosaur movies because, as I said, because I was very one of those dreamy kind of kids, you know, reading books and dreaming about adventures all the time. And of course, between looking for gold and I was looking for dinosaurs. I think it's just so cool that you have this wonderful job. And now, of course, you're in Scotland. I think that is like the perfect place for a paleontologist. I know the university there, and I just love to think of you there. They have to really make you into a movie, I think, because they really do. You are absolutely fantastic, and your stories, the way you are able to, as you said, tell about other paleontologists and share in their excitement, because you guys are always so excited. I think that's one of the wonderful things about paleontology. You always find something new. And you don't mind if somebody else finds something, because then you can rush off and visit them.
Yeah, I think you'd have to really work hard to be a cynic in this line of work. When you get to travel around the world digging up dinosaurs, discovering new fossils that no humans have ever seen before, that are our only evidence for these amazing beasts that lived hundreds of millions of years ago. If you can't get excited about that, then I think, well, you're probably not going to get excited about much. And for me, it's a really cool thing to be living and working here in Scotland. It's not a place I ever thought I would live when I was growing up in Illinois and in the middle of northern Illinois, in the middle of the cornfields and bean fields there. But this career studying dinosaurs has brought me out here to this beautiful city, the Scottish capital, one of the grand old cities of Europe, and an epicenter for geology and for paleontology for many centuries now. And fossils very plentiful in Scotland, but we're starting to find a lot of new dinosaurs here, especially on the Isle of Skye, this gorgeous island off the west coast in the Atlantic, icy cold, rainy, windy, but just enchanting Tolkien-esque landscapes there. And we find dinosaur bones and dinosaur footprints on this island. We're going up again next month, and we're so excited just thinking about what we might find.
Now, let's talk about, everybody always asks, were dinosaurs really colorful? So what have you discovered?
When I was in school, and it wasn't that long ago, I'm in my mid-30s now, so when I was in school in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, all of the textbooks we had and all the books in the school library showed dinosaurs as these drab, gray, green, brown brutes, these dumb animals. Plodding around, lingering around, just waiting to go extinct. Failures. But that's not what dinosaurs were like. We now know that dinosaurs were totally successful. The biggest success stories in the history of Earth, I would say. And they were hyper diverse, and they lived all around the world, and they could move fast, and they had big brains and keen senses. And we also know that they were often flamboyantly colored, and it is amazing, but some paleontologists have figured out a way to tell the colors of ancient dinosaurs, and you can do it if you have really well-preserved feathers or skin, and you can look under a really high-powered microscope, and you can see the individual pigment cells in there, and that can tell you what colors these dinosaurs were, and some of them were green, brown, but some were iridescent. They had those black, shiny feathers like crows do today. Some of them were ginger. Some of them even have had ringed tails like raccoons. So dinosaurs had all kinds of different colors. They were probably very similar to birds today. Look at all the colors that birds have. And to me, and I tell the story in the book, I find it amazing that paleontologists, and it was a young guy, Jakob Winter's his name, who's more or less my age, he figured this out when he was a grad student. He figured out how to tell the color of dinosaurs. I am just find it incredible that somebody had the insight to do that, because we were always told that was impossible. And it's a real inspirational story. It tells us that we should never say anything's impossible in science.
Well, I want to tell you, as I said, I think this book is just so much fun to read. And I want everyone to get it. It's called The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, A New History of a Lost World. And it's just one of these books where you pick it up, you read it once, and then you want to go back. And also, there are like 70 illustrations in here. So it really is also, you know, from that point of view, it's very interesting. We get to see some photos of early paleontologists and of course, some of the bones and some of the places that, my goodness, you've been to so many wonderful places. It's just amazing.
It has been quite an adventure, and I've just been really fortunate to have great colleagues around the world. I know it sounds kind of trite to say that, but I've been really lucky. I've had great mentors at each stage of my career, and I get to work with some incredible people that are great fossil collectors, and hopefully I do justice to their stories in this book, because it is because of this new generation, this very diverse generation of young dinosaur hunters that we know so much these days. And we've learned so much over the last decade. If I tried to write this book a decade ago, I couldn't have done it. And that just makes me so excited about the next decade. Who knows what we're going to learn next about dinosaurs?
Exactly. And you're going to be right there, and you're going to come back and tell us about it, because I think you're also just a great writer and a fascinating person. And I love to think of you up there in Edinburgh and thinking about dinosaurs. I think it's fantastic.
Well, I'm so glad you liked the book, and I hope a lot of you that are listening are enthused by this conversation and go out and check out the book. Of course, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it in your local independent bookshops. Always good to support our local bookshops, and I just really hope that this book will help inspire a new generation of dinosaur hunters and also show kind of the older generation that we have learned so much new about dinosaurs than the stuff they were taught in school.
Okay, well, Steve Brusate, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It has been an absolute joy to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure's all mine.
Okay.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. I'm going to play a little book buzz.
A Dangerous Woman from Nowhere by Chris Radish. This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz mystery. Readers who relish the idea of women forming important bonds of friendship when their will is tested will enjoy A Dangerous Woman from Nowhere by Chris Radish. Here's the buzz. When her husband is kidnapped by ruthless gold miners, frontier woman Briar Logan discovers that adventures of the heart are almost as dangerous as tracking down lawless killers. Desperate to save her husband and the solitary life they have carved out of the wilderness, Briar is forced to accept the help of a damaged young man and a notorious female horse trainer in her journey to find him and bring him home. The unlikely trio form a common bond in order to survive as they face whiskey runners, gold thieves, unpredictable elements, and men who will stop at nothing to get what they want. A Dangerous Woman from Nowhere is a timeless Western adventure story about courage, change, and risk by best-selling author Chris Radish. This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions on the mysteries you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joy on paper. Rita Moreau, buzzing off for now.
Meanwhile, I just want to remind everyone that one of the greatest joys in life is to see your words on paper. That is a real joy. Or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or, if you're really, really lucky, to someday have them spoken on the big screen. So it's up to you. You just have to get out there and write. And meanwhile, make sure that you say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed, who's in the control room, and he's always so nice to me. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. So, bye-bye for now.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543. From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8, it's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life, dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try, but first he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do, a little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all, even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You hope, written by a true American hero. You'll love this book, now available on Amazon. So get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.